Welcome to the Mass Violence Podcast, brought to you by the National Mass Violence Center. I am Carter Coyle. I'm fairly new to the team here at the National Mass Violence Center. I'm the Public Information Director, so I'll be helping out with promotions and publicity, media relations, and all things to help promote NMVC. So I'm very excited to be hosting today's MVP episode, the second of 2024. You know, every year MVP puts together a special edition to recognize National Crime Victims' Rights Week. So that is what we're going to be focusing on today. And National Crime Victims' Rights Week was started by President Ronald Reagan back in 1981. And interestingly, that was just 9 days after he himself was the victim of an attempted assassination. So this year's observance is the week of April 21st to 27th. And it's also a special year of kind of landmark anniversaries in the victim and survivor services field, because it is the 40th anniversary of the Victims of Crime Act, or VOCA as we know it, that created the Crime Victims Fund. And we'll get into that creation and history in just a minute. The 30th anniversary this year of the Violence Against Women Act, and the 20th anniversary of the Federal Crime Victims Rights Act, or CVRA. So we're going to discuss these today and how they tie into the theme of National Crime Victims' Rights Week. The MVP is honored today to host two national leaders in our field to discuss VOCA and CVRA, and in particular, how they help victims and survivors and communities at large after they have a mass violence incident. So we are extremely excited to welcome Steve Dereen and Professor Paul Cassell to join MVP today. Steve Dereen served as the executive director of the National Association of VOCA Assistance Administrators from 2001 to 2019 and represented state agencies that administer state VOCA victim assistance grants. And he previously worked for more than 25 years in the Wisconsin Justice Department, where he served as director of research and information, overseeing all public policy development, including all criminal justice and crime victims' rights legislation. And he subsequently managed the Wisconsin Victim Witness Assistance Program and the Wisconsin VOCA Assistance Programs. Steve has served as an expert consultant to the U.S. Justice Department Office for Victims of Crime, and he's also in the National Board, the board of the National Organization for Victim Advocacy, NOVA, which is a partner of our center. Steve, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi there.
Professor Paul Cassell is a leading researcher on criminal and civil justice issues. He's published many widely cited articles on topics like crime victims' rights, wrongful convictions, interrogation and confessions, and proactive policing. He's also a former U.S. District Judge for the United States District Court for the District of Utah. He's currently the Ronald M. Boyce Presidential Professor of Criminal Law and University Distinguished Professor of Law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, and is a longtime national leader in promoting crime victims' rights. Professor Paul Cassell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, now that we've gotten through ticking off the amazing accomplishments of both of our guests today, I'd like to also welcome our Associate Academic Program Director, Ann Seymour, from the National Mass Violence Center. She is going to give us kind of a foundation related to the 2024 National Crime Victims' Rights Week theme, which we will be talking about today. The theme this year, Ann, is How Would You Help? Options, Services, and Hope for Crime Survivors. And this year's theme begins with a question: how would you help? And you've been in the field now for 40 years. So why is it still important to ask these sort of questions?
Well, Carter, this question is timeless, and we should regularly be asking people, how would you help crime victims and survivors? I feel like too often folks want to be helpful when a loved one or a friend is victimized, but they don't always know what to do. The most important thing is for people to realize that the impact of crime can be felt by survivors for a very long time, and we've certainly seen that in the mass violence field. And we know from research that social support is one of the key factors that can mitigate the trauma of victimization. And then it's helpful to understand the scope of victim impact, and this could be physical, emotional, behavioral, financial, social, or spiritual. And victims' needs are always going to relate to one of those impact areas. I always tell people just being there with and for crime survivors and simply asking them what they need is one of the best ways that we can help.
And the theme also includes options, services, and hope for crime survivors. So as you're thinking about both VOCA and the CVRA, how does this theme resonate with those two incredibly significant federal laws when it comes to victims' rights and services?
Well, you're going to hear from both Steve and Paul about how these laws were major game changers in our field. They greatly increased options for crime survivors, specifically about their rights as victims and how to exercise them, and options available to them to access greatly needed services in the immediate and long-term aftermath of criminal victimization. Over 7,000 programs, including our National Mass Violence Center, are funded by VOCA and the Crime Victims Fund to provide victim services and support. And also, system-based services are available to help victims with their rights to information, notification, victim impact statements, and restitution, among other rights. Finally, when victim autonomy is strengthened by options and services are strengthened by federal laws that continually improve them, then hope for crime victims becomes an actual positive reality.
Thank you so much, Anne. That makes sense. I appreciate you kind of framing our discussion today about VOCA and the Crime Victims' Rights Act and how it ties into this year's theme. So let's get into the discussion of those federal laws that you referenced. Steve Dereen, welcome to the Mass Violence Podcast. So you were involved 40 years ago in helping VOCA become perhaps the most foundational federal law that positively helps, affects, assists crime victim services. So what do you remember about 40 years ago? Can you give us a brief history of the impetus of VOCA back in 1984?
I sure can. Probably more than you would want to hear in terms of its granularity. I remember writing an article once for a publication and edited an article on why history matters. So I think it's important for people today to have an appreciation of how we got where we are today. And VOCA is certainly a foundational federal program, particularly in terms of resources, in terms of funding and support for the things that are really going on at the state, local, and tribal levels. As you mentioned, it's been about 40 years since VOCA was enacted. It really came as an outgrowth of a task force that was established by President Ronald Reagan, a task force on victims of crime, which was an outgrowth in itself of a previous study on just violent crime in the United States. And one of the unique features I thought of this task force, they put together a publication. It was a sort of slim volume. It contained 68 recommendations. And unlike most federal reports and studies and things of that nature, this, it seems to me, was sort of unique in that it actually resulted in less than 2 years in something actually substantial being accomplished, which was the enactment in 1984 of the Victims of Crime Act, or VOCA, as we usually refer to it. And in 1984, when this came about, just to put it into some political context, President Reagan was in charge. There was a great deal of concern about federal spending. There was a great deal of concern about states' rights and why is the federal government intruding into an area that is primarily a state responsibility in terms of most crimes. And this report by the task force addressed those issues, one of which was the realization that victims of federal crimes weren't really getting any assistance at the federal level. And so they looked at states, which many of which at the time had state victim compensation programs. And they felt that if the federal government helped subsidize the cost of those programs, states would continue to provide financial assistance to victims of federal crimes. So that was one of the impetuses. The other was just simply the fact that victims involved with criminal justice programs needed help and support There was an outgrowth. One of my earliest experiences in the state of Wisconsin was working with prosecutor-based victim witness programs, which was premised on the fact that if you assisted victims who were also witnesses, they would be more cooperative with the public safety system, would be more willing to testify. And so a lot of the programs, the system-based programs, grew out of that experience, as well as what was going on with the recognition of women who were victims of sexual assault and domestic violence. Those two movements sort of coalesced into what is today the principal crime victims' rights movement. And so VOCA was enacted to provide financial support. And it came up with, because of this concern over spending, it came up with what was then a rather unique funding mechanism, which is the Crime Victims Fund, that is based primarily on the collection at the federal level of criminal fines and a few other types of penalties. So it avoided a reliance on general taxpayer dollars, which has always been a principle behind VOCA. And so that was very unique. Unlike some of the other programs that have since been enacted at the federal level, which really focus on specific types of crimes, such as VAWA, child abuse, trafficking, et cetera, VOCA has always been designed to support direct services to victims of all types of crime. So it has sort of a generic, broad-based focus on assisting victims.
Pretty brilliant way to structure that in the funding of it. It seems like it'd be harder to argue when it's funded and set up the way it is. So really interesting to hear how that all came about. And if there is one law that offers those theme words of options, services, and hope for crime survivors, it's the Victims of Crime Act. And how does VOCA make this year's National Crime Victims Rights Week a reality, really put that theme into the real life of a crime survivor?
Well, as I said, VOCA was intended to provide financial support to programs that provide direct services. So the resources are really there for hands-on services, training of victim service providers. As Ann alluded to, in 2020, there were over 7,200 programs, which actually had over 11,000, almost 12,000 different projects that were funded through VOCA. Now, again, to put it somewhat in perspective for all folks like me, as I said, when VOCA was enacted, there was concern over spending, federal spending. Nobody actually at the time knew how much the federal government collected in these federal criminal fines. And the first year that VOCA was enacted and collected money for the Crime Victims Fund, it actually collected $68 million. Now, over this period of time, there's been an explosion so that today we're talking billions of dollars that goes into the fund. It's fluctuated from year to year. It's gone up and down. But in contrast to the funding levels that we thought were very dramatic back in 1985, we're now talking billions of dollars that are supporting these programs. To give you one example of the impact, when VOCA was first enacted, there were about 36 states that had state crime victim compensation programs, which are programs that provide direct financial support for out-of-pocket expenses that victims of violent crime experience, medical expenses, mental health counseling, lost wages that directly stem from being the victim of a violent crime. So when VOCA was passed, there were about 36 states. One of the requirements in the original legislation was that states provide coverage to victims who were not residents of that state. And so that expanded coverage. The fact that there was federal funds available actually resulted from 36 to today. Every state has a crime victim compensation program, the District of Columbia, several territories. So it's really been the carrot that has expanded these financial services. And on the assistance side, there are some, I think, 30 million individuals over a two-year span that have gotten direct services through victim assistance programs that are funded by VOCA. So the impact and the scope has been really fantastic. It's been extremely broad. As I mentioned, it covers victims of all types of crime. And so the services, the hope, and the options available to victims. Unfortunately, this is one of the challenges for not just VOCA, but other types of victim services. Relatively few people are aware of what's available to them. And I think there was a report that showed only about 9% of people who reported being a victim of a violent crime were able to actually access services. So there's a great deal more that needs to be done, particularly in terms of outreach and public awareness of the services that are available to them.
Great point, Steve, and that part of that outreach certainly happens in the wake of a mass violence incident. So all of us here at National Mass Violence Center certainly appreciate the services and the support that the Crime Victims Fund has made and continues to make available for victims, communities that experience mass violent incidents. So Steve and Paul, of course, please weigh in on this as well, but I'd like to understand a little bit more how these funds can help with specifically a person who's struggling after a mass violence, experiencing living through a mass violence incident.
Well, the services through this, the basic VOCA victim assistance and crime victim compensation programs are available to victims of mass violence incidents. But over and beyond that, a lot of times these incidents are very costly. They strain the financial resources of the local programs or the state compensation programs. And almost by definition, they're unfortunately, this may be less true today than it had been before, less predictable. So you can't really plan on what your needs may be in terms of responding to victims of mass violence and terrorism. Without going into the whole detailed history, but essentially in 2001, as part of the USA Patriot Act, Congress sort of carved out a special fund, a reserve, if you will, for services and assistance to victims of mass violence and terrorism. It's called the Anti-Terrorism Emergency Reserve. And it was structured in such a way that it's sort of like a revolving fund so that states and state assistance, local assistance programs, state compensation programs can apply to the Office for Victims of Crime for special supplemental funding to address the needs of victims of mass violence and terrorism. So that was set up as sort of a $50 million revolving fund that actually, again, without getting too much in the weeds, is what we refer to as being above the cap. In other words, that money is not in competition with the other regular annual programs. Now, one of the challenges of that reserve fund is that it was actually initially funded with money that came from the September 11th compensation fund. It was about $68 million. And the way this was set up was anything that they spent from the fund could be replenished from the Crime Victims Fund up to a certain limit so that it tops out at $50 million, again, on a revolving basis. So when it's spent down, it can be replenished. Now, one of the challenges today is as fund collections have decreased and the balance in the fund has decreased, if it were ever to get to the point where there was no balance in the fund, replenishing that fund could be in jeopardy. Now, there are some proposals to address that problem, but that's one of the problems that we see not only at the local level, but possibly with the mass violence programs in terms of replenishing. However, like last year, there was, I believe, about $18 million that was actually spent out of that fund for programs. So the money going to the programs to supplement the money that was otherwise available through state and local resources is spread out over years. So that $18 million isn't the sum total of their obligations to support the programs, merely how much they've paid out in that year. The principal use of the Anti-Terrorism Emergency Reserve is to supplement state and local assistance programs and state compensation programs. In addition to that, Congress created a special program for victims of international terrorism, which we refer to as ITVERB, which is the International Terrorism Victim Expense Reimbursement Program. Again, it's sort of narrow in its scope, but it can be a very important resource for people who are victims of international terrorism. And that also comes out of the Anti-Terrorism Emergency Reserve.
Thank you so much, Steve, for breaking that down. Makes sense to me. And you kind of referenced this, but I do know from talking to Anne and others at our center that a lot of people are really worried about cutbacks, recent cutbacks to the Crime Victims Fund, that revolving door, will it still be revolving? So how do cutbacks like that negatively impact crime victim services? Should we be worried about this? What's being done?
Yeah, it definitely is a worry. I've done studies of the Crime Victims Fund and the revenues going into it for the Department of Justice. And one of my basic takeaways of studying the fund and its viability, just to give you a quick summary of it. Since the fund was set up in October of 1984, there's been roughly $36 billion deposited into the fund. Also, since that time, as I said, the money comes principally from fines imposed on people convicted of federal criminal offenses. We know from U.S. Sentencing Commission reports there have been over 240,000 people convicted of federal crimes who have been ordered to pay a monetary fine. But of those 240,000 plus federal offenders, two-thirds of the $26 billion or so have been paid for by only 80 criminal defendants. That's 0.0033%. In other words, the real substantial deposits into the fund comes from very unusual, super huge criminal cases. The largest one was VW, paid almost $3 billion in a criminal fine. That was only part of their ultimate settlement, but $3.9 billion went into the Crime Victims Fund. Those things don't happen every day. And they're not the kind of things that you can rely on to be, to forecast stable funding. So the amounts going into the fund, the big amounts that the fund really has been dependent upon, are really sort of scattered. And there was a period, because of a number of corporate policies and whatever, the federal government has really, they tried to develop different strategies to encourage compliance, particularly by corporations, with abiding by the law, which is not a bad policy to say, well, people should obey the law. The result of that was different strategies, including the use, for example, of deferred prosecution agreements. If you pay a certain amount of money and you follow these rules, you have a monitor, we won't criminally charge your company. And those monies, for many years, because they were not technically convictions, were not going into the fund. Now, in 2021, Congress amended the VOCA Act to say those monies, which are essentially the functional equivalent of a fine, will now go into the fund. So some of the money that would go into the fund has been sort of made up for with these additional revenues. Now, they've been very helpful. They haven't solved the problem. They haven't increased amounts that otherwise would be going into the fund, but they've made up for what were potentially continuing losses of deposits. So that was a good thing, but it really doesn't get the fund back to where it was to sustain the level of services that have sort of grown up with VOCA funding, particularly since 2015. So that's the challenge. And just recently, by the time this podcast airs, we may have some more information, but we do know at this time that there are some proposals to address the funding challenges on a longer term basis. And we can only, try to support those efforts and come up with strategies that we can continue to sustain the level of programs, including the programs that are helping victims of mass violence in the future.
Well, thank you, Steve. Very understandable why you're considered the VOCA guru of our field. And throughout our discussion, Paul was nodding along and kind of pointing to you for our VOCA questions. But Professor Cassell, we're honored to have you here today too and reflect back on CVRA and how it was different. How did it come about? You referenced a presidential task force back in the 80s. So tell me about that history.
Yeah, it's interesting that while VOCA was developing and promoting victim services, there was also, I think, a sort of tandem effort or parallel effort to develop rights for crime victims in the criminal justice process. And just as VOCA could trace its roots back to the President's Task Force on Victims of Crime back in 1982, which issued a report, you see the same thing with the CVRA, and it's a very interesting history. That task force report came out in 1982, and one of the, I think it's fair to say, surprising or sweeping recommendations, maybe is a better word in there, was the recommendation that the United States Constitution should be amended to provide rights for crime victims. Just as there is a Bill of Rights for criminal defendants, the task force said there ought to be a Bill of Rights for victims of those crimes. And as you know, amending the United States Constitution is a very significant step. It's only been done a couple of dozen times in American history over the last 200 years. And it also requires a great deal of groundwork, a strong consensus across the country that an amendment needs to be added into the Constitution. And so I remember, and I think some of the participants on this call may remember as well, that there was a meeting a few years after the task force report, and the issue was, all right, how should the state victims' rights movement move forward with laying the groundwork for this proposed constitutional amendment? And what emerged out of those discussions around the country was this idea of a states first strategy. Steve has already mentioned, you know, considerable attention being paid, not just in that period of time, I suppose, but in all periods of time, about the proper balance between the federal government and the state government and how that should work. And so one of the advantages of a federalist system, where you do have 50 different states and the District of Columbia scattered around the country, of course, is you can have what's known as the laboratory, the great laboratory of federalism, the laboratory of the states. And so the victims' rights movement then began going into different states to try to pass state constitutional amendments protecting crime victims' rights. And depending on how you keep score, you can say, well, maybe the first one was in Michigan or maybe Rhode Island or maybe California, a number of different states vying for credit, I suppose, for the earliest amendment. But over time, beginning in around 1984 and thereafter in the 80s and early 90s, a number of states passed their own state constitutional amendments providing a Bill of Rights for crime victims. And as that moved forward into the 90s, about probably two-thirds, maybe verging on three-quarters of the states had passed their own state constitutional amendments protecting crime victims' rights. And the victims' rights movement then thought, okay, we now have that groundwork laid. We now have examples of successful amendments in many of the states around the country. Let's go back to that idea of amending the federal constitution to add a Bill of Rights. And so in the President Clinton was president, of course, from 1992 to about 2001. And during that period of time, President Clinton announced his support, along with many other leaders in the other political party as well. This was very much a bipartisan effort. But he announced his support in a Rose Garden ceremony for a federal constitutional amendment. And that recommendation was taken up by Congress. There were hearings held in the late 1990s and early 2000s about this idea of a federal constitutional amendment. Two of the leaders in Congress were Senator Dianne Feinstein, who, of course, recently passed away, and Senator John Kyle and the other political party who recently retired. But the two of them spearheaded the efforts to try to pass a federal constitutional amendment. And those efforts came to a head in 2004. The vote count was somewhat close. It looked like there was going to be a majority in favor of a federal constitutional amendment. But it actually requires under the Constitution a two-thirds vote, 67 senators, which is difficult to get 67 senators to agree on just about anything. And so the victims' rights movement realized that they were a few votes short. And so after conferencing with Senator Feinstein and Senator Kyle, the victims' movement shifted gears from a federal constitutional amendment, which would have applied not only in federal proceedings, but also in state criminal justice proceedings. And instead, the idea was to pass the Crime Victims' Rights Act, the CVRA, as it's known today, which would be a federal statutory provision providing a Bill of Rights for crime victims in federal criminal cases. And the thinking was, if there was a state-of-the-art, strong federal statute illustrating how constitutional rights could be protected in the federal criminal justice system, then other states might be able to use that as a model or improve their existing structures and pass their own statutes that would protect victims' rights. And so in about October of 2004, the Crime Victims' Rights Act was passed by bipartisan majorities in both houses of Congress, signed into law by President Bush. And it's been on the books now. I guess we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of the CVRA later this year. And so that really set the stage for federal crime victims' rights. And it also, I think it's fair to say, has set the stage for additional developments over the last several decades in various states to improve the rights of crime victims as they move through the criminal justice process.
I have to say how admirable it is that victims' rights advocates just kept at it. I mean, that's years and years of, hey, let's pivot. Let's think of something different. How are we going to make sure this happens so that victims are protected? It's really amazing. And I know, Judge Casselli, you've been involved in a number of higher profile federal cases, too, where you led the efforts to ensure victims' statutory rights under the CVRA were upheld. So just because the law is in place doesn't necessarily mean that it's followed or upheld, but you're ensuring that as your work, you were ensuring that as you worked as a judge. So can you give us an example of that and how CVRA made a positive difference for a crime victim?
Well, yeah, let me talk about a few of those cases, and let me focus on a couple of cases involving mass violence, since I know that's of interest, sadly, for our listeners on this podcast. But I think one of the things that set the stage for the CVRA was the Oklahoma City bombing case, in which Timothy McVeigh and an accomplice, Terry Nichols, bombed the federal building, federal office building in Oklahoma City, the Murrow office building, killing more than 100 people and injuring hundreds more. And so those cases were prosecuted as death penalty cases. They were prosecuted in the federal system. There was potentially a joint federal jurisdiction there, but because the attack was on a federal office building, the federal prosecutors took the lead. And during the course of that case, a victim's rights issue came up. It was a death penalty case, and the federal judge presiding over the case ruled that if a victim's family member wanted to testify in the penalty phase of the case about what penalty was proper, that made them a witness in the case, and therefore they couldn't sit in the courtroom and see whether Timothy McVeigh was guilty or not. They couldn't listen to the evidence. And for many of us in the movement, that seemed both a shocking result, just from a common sense point of view. They weren't going to be providing testimony about the details of the bombing, but why should they be required to sit outside the courtroom? It was also a shocking decision legally, because there was a federal law at the time that had promised to crime victims that they would be excluded from what are known as witness sequestration rules, the rules requiring witnesses sometimes to sit outside the courtroom, and the judge had seemingly overlooked that. So along with some of my friends in the victims' rights movement, I filed a motion in federal court challenging their exclusion. The district judge overruled that challenge. We appealed to the 10th Circuit. They overruled the challenge, saying the victims didn't have standing to pursue those issues, no right to enforce those issues. And so we went to Congress to try to get a change in the law. We did get a change in the law, but the judge said it wasn't enough. And so all of that in the late 90s, I think, kind of set the stage for the CVRA, which, in fact, during the legislative debates on the CVRA, the Oklahoma City bombing case was specifically mentioned as an example of how previous federal laws had been too weak to protect victims' rights and ensure that they were able to attend court proceedings. So That was part of the CVRA. The CVRA has a mass victim provision in it, which indicates that if there's a situation where victims need to get notices, but it may not be possible to individually knock on the door or have face-to-face contact with each and every victim, that the Justice Department can try to come up with reasonable approaches to provide notification. And so, as some of the listeners of this podcast may be aware, in mass victims cases now, the United States Department of Justice, and I think many state agencies as well, rely on websites and other kinds of modern technologies, including automated telephone services and other things like that, automated emails to provide notifications to, in some cases, hundreds or even thousands of victims who may be following along in a particular case. And so there have been some court challenges involving that. I was involved in a case down in Texas, the BP or British Petroleum case, in which a plea deal was reached and the Justice Department hadn't provided advance notice to that, hadn't conferred with the victims about that. And the Fifth Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit said, well, wait a minute, the Crime Victims' Rights Act has been passed. People can agree or disagree with the law, but that is the law. And that law says that victims have to be notified and they have to have an opportunity to confer with prosecutors and try to shape the outcomes of plea bargains so that the victim's perspective is reflected in the outcome of those cases.
And that makes me think that whether it's a state level case, you know, something that might not ever reach the desk of a federal judge, or one of these big cases with multiple victims, the rights that they're entitled to are the same, and being involved in the case and having updates in the case. So probably a good time to mention some of what some of those rights actually are that we've been referencing. But certainly I know the right to be updated on the case, to weigh in on plea deals that come up. Are there any others, Judge Cassell, that you'd want to make sure we highlight?
Yeah, the CVRA, I think, has set the stage, and many states have similar provisions now as well. But three of the key rights are the right to be notified, the right to be present, and the right to be heard at appropriate points in the process. And those, I think, hopefully many of the listeners here take those things for granted, but I think some of us who are getting a little bit older can remember a day and age when the criminal justice system did not notify crime victims about what was going on. They were known as the forgotten man or the forgotten person in the criminal justice system, that they would trot in when the prosecutor issued a subpoena to them to testify at the case. But other than that, they really weren't involved. Nowadays, of course, victims get notifications in almost all states about court proceedings that are moving forward. They do have the right to attend those court hearings, and except in special situations, even if they're going to be a witness in the case, they have a right to attend those court hearings. It's interesting. One of the mantras of the crime victims movement is that, well, we just want to be treated like criminals. You know, the defendant gets to sit there and watch the proceedings. You know, why can't we similarly extend rights to victims to attend? And then victims have the right to be heard. They can't jump up in the middle of a trial or something and disrupt the proceedings. But there are obviously important points in the process where the victim's voice should be heard. For example, at bail hearings, if somebody's going to be released, he might present a danger to the victim or to the community, and the victim can provide input on that. Not to have a veto over whether or not the defendant gets released, but to have a voice in that process. And similarly, at plea bargains, at sentencing, victim impact statements, I think are well known to many people nowadays. Those are the kinds of rights that are there. The CVRA also expanded, included some other rights. So we've already mentioned briefly the right to confer with prosecutors. Back in the day, the prosecutors would reach a plea bargain and the victims never would have a chance to even say, hey, wait a minute, have you thought about this issue? Or have you thought about restitution? Or were you aware the defendant has done this on previous occasions in other states, or other information that the victim might possess that the prosecutors didn't possess? So there's a conferral right. There's a right to notification about services that are available under, for example, VOCA now. Also the right to reasonable protection. The right to proceedings free from unreasonable delay so that the case doesn't drag on forever. And those are the kinds of rights that are now enshrined in the CVRA and also enshrined in many similar state statutes and state constitutional amendments around the country.
those of us who live here in Charleston, South Carolina, the CVRA took on a special meaning for our community after the mass shooting at Mother Emanuel Church at that Bible study in 2015. 9 people were killed, 1 physically injured, really one of those incidents that hurt the whole community and traumatized many people. And the defendant in that case was indicted for 33 federal hate crime and murder charges and found guilty on all 33 of those after a long federal trial. I covered that trial as a journalist at the time. So hearing a lot of what you're talking about now and reflecting back on being in the courtroom, you know, I'm thinking of the family members who were able to testify. I'm thinking of Ethel Lance's son who was deaf and had a sign language interpreter there, which I have to imagine was all part of his rights of hearing what was happening at the trial. But can you talk a little bit more about that case specifically, or maybe hate and identity motivation type crimes?
Well, yes, that case is an illustration, I think, of how the landscape for crime victims has changed over the last several decades. You mentioned some of the things that were done to make sure that victims, or in a homicide case, of course, when we're talking about victims, we're talking about victims' family members who serve as representatives of the person who's been killed. And so nowadays, I think one of the things that's happened, in fairness to prosecutors, I don't think prosecutors back in the day were evil people trying to keep victims excluded or anything like that, but they didn't lack some of the tools that are necessary. And let's remember, a case like the one that you're describing is extremely complicated legally, requires a great deal of focus from prosecutors to avoid legal errors along the way, to present evidence and to handle the legal side of the case. So what's developed in a lot of prosecutors' office is a victim witness coordinator, an office within the prosecutor's office whose task is to make sure the victims are notified about the hearings, to assist them in getting to those hearings, to provide, as you mentioned, translation services or other kinds of services to hear the proceedings. Just an update on, hey, there's going to be a hearing next week, and we will, that this one's not an important hearing, but then 2 weeks from now is an important hearing, you may want to attend. Those kinds of questions are very central to victims who are trying to follow along in proceedings, and there's now a point of contact and the tools. In a case like that, I don't know exactly how many people would have been involved in the victim service side of things, but I'm sure it was a number of people that were specially trained and specially equipped with different tools to provide notifications to victims. And also, I think judges have become more familiar with victims as being part of the landscape. I mentioned the Timothy McVeigh case. I think the judge was sort of surprised when victims wanted to show up in court and listen to what was happening. Nowadays, victims are a routine part of the criminal justice architecture, sitting in the front row and providing victim impact statements at sentencing. So I just think the entire system has become much more accommodating for victims today than it was several decades ago.
Now, what about in a case like the Mother Emanuel case, where the defendant was also charged with 9 counts of murder in South Carolina state court, to which he later pled guilty, had already gotten the death penalty in the federal case. So what is this concept of dual jurisdiction? Why is it important to still pursue those state charges? And whether state victims' rights statutes or the Federal Crime Victims' Rights Act, how do you use those to define victims' rights?
Yeah, well, this goes back to the point that I think Steve was alluding to during his comments. We do live in a federalist system where we have both federal crimes and state crimes. And so as a result, we have both federal laws like the Crime Victims' Rights Act or VOCA that cover federal proceedings specifically, the CVRA providing the list of rights that victims can expect to exercise when they're watching something happen in federal court. But then you need to go to state constitutions, like South Carolina has its own constitutional amendment protecting crime victims' rights and a state statutory scheme that protects victims' rights as well. And the reason it's important to have both of those is that there is, as you've alluded to, dual jurisdiction. And so sometimes there's a federal interest that needs to be served by pursuing a prosecution, but there may be a parallel state interest as well. I mentioned the Oklahoma City bombing case. That was an attack on a federal office building and federal office workers. And so there the federal interest was viewed as preeminent. But you can have other cases where the situation is reversed and maybe the state interest is viewed as a stronger one and the federal interest isn't quite so strong. And so that's something that federal and state prosecutors will negotiate among themselves and decide who has the lead and who will go first. But hopefully both regimes, both systems are going to have protections for crime victims when the case moves forward to trial.
One other kind of add-on question here, but when you have multiple victims, it may be hard to do what every single victim wants in a case. Some may agree with the death penalty, others may not. But is the important thing that they are all heard?
Yes, you put your finger on it. I mean, you know, you could, it's, if we talk about this in my crime victims rights class at law school, if you were going to go back to the drawing board and draw up a criminal justice system, would you want a system where victims were in charge of everything? And then what would you do if there were, for example, in a mass violence case, 10 victims or families who wanted a death penalty and 10 victims who did not? How would you sort through those disputes? Well, I think it's interesting. You could make a theoretical case for a system that was run by victims and run by individuals, but there are some theoretical problems that would surface pretty quickly, as you imagine. And over the last 200 years in America, our system has essentially been one of public prosecution. It's interesting, if you do go back 200 years ago, there was a system of private prosecution where victims would perhaps initiate the case and try to get restitution. But I think as we've become a more urban society, if you think about what crime looks like in major urban areas in America today, I think it'd be very difficult for an individual to handle the law enforcement side of things. So we have public prosecutors that make the decisions as best they can for the public. Let's remember, crime victims and their families are part of the public, so they ought to certainly have a voice in the process and probably a leading voice in that process because they've been affected more directly by crime than by a particular crime than the public at large has. But then we rely on prosecutors to make the difficult decision about what kinds of charges will be filed, what kinds of plea bargains will be accepted, what sorts of sentences should be argued for, those kinds of choices, all now supplemented by the voice of the victim as the case moves through the criminal justice process.
Well, Steve Doreen, Paul Cassell, and Seymour, thank you all so much for your time today. This was such a relevant discussion, reflecting on the history, the importance of VOCA and CVRA. We are really looking forward to the 2024 National Crime Victims Rights Week, because it's such a landmark year for several of these federal laws and anniversaries for them. And I think it's a great time to remember all the work that went into passing these laws over the years, thanks to supporters and advocates like both of you. So we really appreciate your time and a kind of a trip down history lane. We also really appreciate the Department of Justice and the Office of Victims for Crime for that important week that they put together and really the work that they do for mass violence victims year round. So a shout out to OVC and our appreciation to everyone there who helps victims and survivors of mass violence. Thank you all again for joining us on this episode of the Mass Violence Podcast, MVP.